Welcome to the Gospel Rain Podcast, part of the teaching ministry of Dr. Matt Brown and Dr. Micah Carter. We hope you will find gospel-centered answers to your questions about theology and the Christian life. And now, we welcome you to the Gospel Rain Conversation.
Welcome back again to the Gospel Rain Podcast. I'm sitting here with Dr. Matt Brown, and we're excited to be back behind the microphone. As promised, Matt, we kicked it kind of back off last time, and here we are. We're trying to deliver the goods,
we stayed with it another time, right?
At least one more time. And so great to tackle some more, you know, theological and biblical matters that relate to Christian life and really Christian interests. I mean, what we're going to talk about today is somewhat puzzling to a lot of people, especially as they're working their way through reading the scripture. You know, it's funny you mentioned last time that when we start an annual Bible reading project and we're going to read the Bible through in a year, and you get to Leviticus and you're just eyeball deep in all kinds of weird, interesting things.
Yeah.
And a lot of people kind of just abandon the whole project at that point. But if you can make it through, 1 Kings is going to test you.
Yes. Okay,
so... But
you get to a lot of names you can't pronounce.
But one of the things that you mentioned last time, you know, some of the stuff that you've been preaching through on Wednesday nights and helping your folks kind of think about and wrestle through is some of the Old Testament theology, some of the concepts and the things that God is doing with Israel, especially through the Law of Moses and some of that stuff. And one of those major things that it does bleed over into the New Testament, but the New Testament handles it differently, is the issue of clean and unclean animals.
Right.
And more than animals, insects and other kind of stuff. And this is relevant for me in the sense that it preaches the book of Mark that John the Baptist was eating wild honey and locusts. Mm-hmm. And I kind of discovered and made the case that, you know, he was obedient to the law by eating a ceremonially clean insect.
Yeah.
Now, that was really fascinating. And so... You know, we've got a big topic to kind of cover in this sense, because by the time we get to Peter's ministry in the book of Acts, chapter 10, Peter is told by Jesus that all things have been made clean. Mm-hmm. And Peter pushes back on that. He's like, no, I'm not going to eat unclean things. And Jesus said, what I've made clean, don't call unclean. So help us think through this issue. I know you've got a lot of different ways you can go with this, but in the Old Testament, we're going to immerse ourselves in this conversation with specifically clean and unclean, you know, ratifications from the Lord and the law. And then how do we handle that today?
Well, actually, the clean and unclean animals are actually defined in some categories in the book of Leviticus chapter 11. I think Deuteronomy chapter 19, both of those give... clarifications of what was clean and what was unclean according to the law. And so if you look up Leviticus chapter 11, I'm not going to read all that, but you see four different categories of animals that are clean and unclean. So it starts with the land animals, and then you got water animals, and then you got air, birds, and those kind of things. Then you have insects. So there's four different categories are broken up in Leviticus chapter 11 of what's clean and then what's unclean. So different,
that's helpful.
You know, different clarifications are given. So like a land animal, they only things that were clean were animals that have a cloven hoof and they chew the cud. Okay, if they had both of those, then those were clean animals. If they didn't do both of those or have both of those, then it's an unclean animal. So, for instance, you have a cow.
Yeah.
Okay, a cow has cloven hoofs and also chews the cud. So that animal is clean. But then you have other animals that are unclean, like a camel. All right, a camel chews the cud, but a camel does not have cloven hooves. Mm-hmm. And then you have the other animal like a pig, all right? So pig, we always know in Old Testament, is unclean,
all
okay?
Right.
So, but there's a reason why it's unclean is because it also has cloven hooves, but it does not chew the cud. So that's what makes that unclean. Now, the pig is singled out as being the dirtiest animal for a Jew, maybe. And there's some truth to that, but there were lots of unclean animals based on the same classifications.
Do we have any Old Testament explanation why the cloven hoof and the chewing of the
it's
cud?
It's a good question, and that's what we're going to get into as to why.
Okay.
Matter of fact, I even, as I'm in my reading, I found out that that some Jews even today say that the reason why we don't, why they don't eat the pig, is because it is of all animals the greatest hypocrite. The trickster animal. I thought this was really funny because if you watch a pig lay down on its side, it sticks his hooves straight out as if to say, look, my hooves are cloven. So I'm clean.
Oh, my goodness.
It's sort of like a tricky animal. You know, he sticks his feet straight up, which is funny, you know. But anyway, and so you have different classifications of the other animals too. So you have the water aquatic animals, right? So what makes an aquatic animal clean is that if it has fins and if it has scales. So if both of those are true, then it's clean. Both of those aren't true, it's unclean. So in our world today, a catfish, it has fins, but it does
no
not
scales.
Have scales, so it's not clean. Shellfish.
Man, I love catfish.
I know. Shellfish, same way. So, you know, these other crabs, you got shrimp, it doesn't have fins or scales, or doesn't have scales. So anyway, those are classifications for clean and unclean animals. And then you have the birds, all right? Mm-hmm. Birds are unclean if they're predatory birds, they're unclean, which is interesting. In Leviticus chapter 11, it mentions a bunch of different kinds of birds that are unclean. And if you notice in the list, it lists a whole bunch of different kinds of owls.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. But those are all predatory birds. A predatory bird was unclean if it eats other meat. If it's a scavenger bird, like a vulture, it's unclean. All those kind of things. If it's a predatory or scavenger bird.
By the way, interesting just point of trivia. One of the Old Testament scholars that worked on the Christian Standard Bible was also an ornithologist. So he loved birds.
Really?
He's been all over the world looking at birds and whatnot. So he has... His fingerprints are all over. I can just see, because I'm looking at this and I'm like, Dr. Steinman, what? I mean, some of this stuff, I'm just like, dude, what is a hoopoe?
I know.
A hoopoe. He knows.
I know. Maybe he knows.
But anyway.
I don't know.
Now, but in this list right here, they don't. He doesn't give any clean birds.
He doesn't give any clean
right?
birds. He just clarifies what is unclean.
Okay.
As a matter of fact,
okay.
In that whole list of predatory birds, there's two birds that really stick out.
Okay.
One is a gull, a seagull.
Right.
And the other one is a stork.
Right.
Which is really interesting that they're not predatory birds necessarily. A stork could be, or a seagull could be too, because it eats other animals. It eats other fish. But one of the things that makes makes birds unclean is that they live on land and water. If they live on both, they're unclean.
Gotcha.
All right. So those are things that would clarify. Now, or classify an unclean bird. Now, you have the final section, which is insects.
Mm-hmm.
And then what makes an insect unclean, basically, is that if it is an insect that walks on all of its legs. My wife came up with a really interesting question to say, well, no, wait a minute. It says if it walks on all fours, insects have six legs, not four. Which may seem like an inconsistency, but there it's talking about their two legs of an insect. If they if they're jointed and they hop on them like a grasshopper, then they're clean.
Mm-hmm.
But if all six legs they walk on them, it's unclean. So it's interesting how all that works. All right,
wow.
So we look at that stuff and go, okay, now wait a minute. We don't do all that now. Why in the world do they do that then? So that becomes the big question.
Well, later on it talks about lizards and stuff too.
That's right. Slithering things and all that are unclean. swarming things are unclean.
Yeah.
So he gives descriptions of what would be a clean and unclean animal, basically. Okay?
Okay, can we just say this right here?
Yeah.
All right. These folks wandering around in the wilderness. Okay.
Yeah.
They stumble upon some creature,
yep.
And they're thinking, "I'm going to eat that."
That's right.
But I mean, I'm as far as I know, I've never eaten an insect at this point in my life.
You need,
and I don't
we need to, right?
I mean, I'm not thinking, you know, that skink crawling on that tree. That looks tasty. I'm not thinking about, you know, an Egyptian vulture.
No.
Yeah, I'm just saying. No. I'm not saying the Lord has a sense of humor in all this, but I'm just saying. he itemized some things here really?
Yeah.
I mean, was this a real thing? I mean, was this a... It had to be.
Yeah, it had to be. Yeah, for their time where they were and their culture and all these were animals they were going to run across that, you know, they had to be clear. Can I eat that? Can I not? Mm-hmm. Now, the question becomes, and as if that's not weird enough, all right, the question becomes, why in the world is all of that the case? Okay, I understand clean and unclean, and okay, I'll give you that, but why? What difference does it make? And what made something clean and unclean? So one of the things that has to be really clarified is the fact that now some people will disagree with this, that clean and unclean is not dependent on the health or the hygiene of the animal. All right. A lot of people say today that, okay, we need to go back. And there are books. Yeah. There are many books written today on diet books, and there's 1,000 of them out there, 1,000,000 of them out there. All right, so we're going to go on a diet. We're going to go back and do it the way the Old Testament did it because God told them to stay away from unclean animals that were unclean, that were unhealthy. Okay, we shouldn't be eating pigs because it's unhealthy for us. Mm. We shouldn't eat these kind of things because but why God gave those laws doesn't seem to be for health reasons. Okay, matter of fact, and here's the good a good point, case in point. If that were the reason why things were unclean in the Old Testament or for health reasons, there would have been no reason for God to declare them clean in the New Testament because they're still unhealthy.
True.
That were the case.
Very true.
All right, so you can't make that really as the argument that they're health reasons. So it's not necessarily because of the health of the hygiene of the animal, whether or not it sends your cholesterol through the roof or whatever. It's not really that. Mm-hmm. The clean and unclean had more to do with, and this is a great way of describing this, is that God was using something as common as their food to paint a picture and give an illustration for them of what holiness was. Okay? So through clean and unclean, God was giving through the food a picture that he wanted them to be very careful that they didn't walk in the realm of following God and then walk in a pagan realm at the same time. In other words, he didn't want them to have one foot in spiritual Israel and then another foot in pagan idolatry.
Yeah.
And so if you look at these animals, what God is what God has done, a lot of what's being talked about here is the mixing of different categories. The mixing of different boundaries, okay? So you're going to find that one of the things that God does not, one of the things that makes a bird unclean is that if it lives on land and water. In other words, that bird crosses boundaries. Mm. So God said, if you have a bird that crosses boundaries, don't eat it. Mm-hmm. It's not because the bird is unhealthy. It's because I want to remind you that when you sit down to eat your meal, I never want you crossing boundaries with the idol-worshipping pagan world. Mm. I don't want you to have one foot in both. I want you to stay true to holiness. Stay true to me. Now, so God was using food as an illustration of that. So if we can boil it down as to why clean and unclean, that is the simplest understanding of clean and unclean. God is trying to simply remind them through their food, there's a certain way I want you to act. There's a certain way I want you to live, and I do not want you crossing into sinfulness and in pagan idolatry. I want you to walk with me, be holy, Leviticus chapter 11, same chapter, verse 44, be holy because I am holy.
I think that you boiled it down to really, isn't this also called the holiness code?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we can lose sight of the fact that God is consecrating his people because he's sending them into, as you mentioned, the pagan nations that he has a lot to say, not just about food. I know we're kind of isolating that out.
Right.
But how you handle yourself sexually, how you interface, you know, in terms of business, what kinds of, you know, there's a lot of different things that he says in the holiness code that marks his people off, you know, in some very distinct ways from the culture they're going to be immersed in.
That's exactly
right. That's a huge thing.
That's exactly because it deals the holiness code deals with things like food and clothing. It deals with agriculture, civil life. It deals with marriage. It deals with sex. It deals with property. It deals with all the animals, all those kind of things. The holiness laws deal with all kinds of stuff, not just food. And in all of those laws, God is using things as illustrations to teach them how to walk in holiness.
So
at least these were going to be constant reminders that they were to live as holy people in every area of life. There was, and the book that I've been reading a good bit from to help me with all this, he says there was no division between the sacred and the secular, between the holy and the profane. God was using everything in their life, not just temple life.
Right.
God was using everything, food, everything common to show them how he wanted them to walk, what was holy life and what was a profane life. So he's using all of these things as pictures, illustrations.
A lot of it seems like such minutia. You know, because, I mean, he deals with mildew on different types of fabrics and stuff like that. And then of course, because he's isolating this category of clean and unclean, that should an Israelite defile himself or herself, then there's a whole process of, you know, becoming clean again, ceremonially clean, so that you participate in the community life and worship and stuff like that.
And
right?
You make a good distinction, too, that ceremonially clean, when they became ceremonially unclean, by, for instance, the law says don't touch a dead carcass, okay, or a carcass is dead, right? So don't touch a carcass. If you do, you become ceremonially unclean. Mm-hmm. All right, now there are ways God always provided a way for them to become ceremonially clean again. It's not that touching a carcass made your hands dirty. You got junk on you, right? And so you got to go wash that off. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about hygiene. We're talking about God saying, I have set things apart in my law to say, do these things and don't do these things. But these are reminders. These are not just arbitrary laws. God is saying, I am setting up for you pictures in common life that will help you know what I expect of you and how I want you to walk. These are pictures of things spiritually that God is expecting of them. So you could become ceremonially clean again if you went through the process again.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, someone like Samson. So when you fast forward, he finds a beehive with honey in a carcass of a dead lion.
That's right.
And he touches the carcass to get the honey to serve. But here's one who's set apart, Nazarite vow, all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
Holy to God. And he defiles himself by his own pleasure in opposition to the obedience to God, right?
Exactly.
So, I mean, this stuff is really relevant for how the Bible unfolds itself later on down the road. So these things matter.
That's right. They do. And that's what God is going to be is teaching them through all of this, is that if you choose to eat the unclean animal, then what you're doing in essence is, again, we're not talking about hygiene necessarily. What you're doing in essence is you are rejecting the command of God to be holy like he is holy. Mm-hmm. And so the food is just simply a representative of that. Like I was preaching, let me illustrate it this way. I was preaching Sunday about your foul language, obscene language from Ephesians chapter 5. Mm-hmm. All right. The language that comes out of your mouth, the reason that's obscene and reason why Paul says avoid that is because that's actually a reflection of what's going on deeper inside of you spiritually. Mm-hmm. So same way with the food laws. Mm-hmm. It's not just the food that is the concern. It's what's going on deeper. It's whether or not I'm going to live for him or not, okay?
Right.
Whether or not I'm going to follow his law, whether or not I'm going to avoid what he has prohibited. So these are often called kosher laws in the Old Testament.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Yeah, kosher is a word we even still use that now, because you go to the grocery store, you see kosher on a lot of things, and things have a certain stamp or label that's, you know, specifically or officially kosher. The word kosher means proper. It means correct. Okay. So that's what the word kosher means. Now, some people have questions all the time about what's kosher now and what can't they eat now. Well, a lot of Orthodox Jews still follow these Orthodox laws in the book of Leviticus. So Jews, even now, Orthodox Jews will go to the grocery store and they will look for things that are kosher. For instance, you have... one of the kosher laws is that you can't eat any vegetable that's grown in the field where another vegetable is growing. Same way.
Okay.
God doesn't, and he's using the same picture to say, I don't want you mixed. I don't want you mixing with the world, okay? Mm-hmm. Mixing with unholiness. He's just using that as a picture. So don't eat vegetables that are mixed in the same field with another vegetable.
And okay? They would know that how? Through a blessing of a rabbi?
Yeah, or like today?
Or something. Yeah, like today. Yeah.
There are certain companies that actually are, they actually follow and process and package foods today according to kosher laws.
Gotcha.
So okay. They trust their companies that work this way, and so they will make sure that certain things have not been planted together with other things. One of the things that the law is very specific about in the book of Leviticus is that, and we talked about this in Leviticus 11, insects are really classified there as what you can and can't eat. Well, one of the big problems is any gardener knows with vegetables and fruits is insects. Mm-hmm. And so kosher companies, when they go to package food and stuff like that, especially today, is they have to make sure very carefully that the vegetables and fruits are washed off, sometimes individually scrubbed one at a time to make sure there are no insects when that was packaged or processed so that it doesn't become unclean or unkosher.
Mm.
So even today, our Jewish friends are still following these laws the best that they can. Now, they will even say now, I've read on done some research on some of this stuff lately, is that some of the Jews now will say, well, in the Bible, locusts were clean, but nowadays we don't consider them clean. A lot of Jews will say that now because of so much time has passed. Now, genetically, there's so many different kinds of locusts, we don't know which ones are included in that or not, so we just avoid them all.
Well, text says any kind of locust.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and this raises a very interesting point about really, truly following the Word of God.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, how can you just arbitrate that you're going to do that?
I know.
And then why would you allow a rabbi to authorize that view and not the rabbi in the New Testament?
That's right.
Who has made it
all. That's interesting. That's a great point.
You know?
Great point. Where Jesus says, is in the Gospel of Mark, where Jesus says that everything is clean.
Yeah.
In other words, he says it's not what goes in your mouth that will defy, it's what comes out, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Because he says everything is clean. And then the story you talked about in Acts chapter 10, where Peter sees the God in a vision let down the sheet and all these different clean and unclean animals, because it's very specific. It says that in the sheet are clean and unclean animals together.
Right.
And you wouldn't do that anyway. You wouldn't put clean and unclean animals together in the same area. But God did in the same sheet. And then he said, eat, because they're all clean.
Right.
And that's when Peter, you know, says, wait, I've never eaten anything unclean. He says, but it's don't call unclean what I've called clean. So we get the idea in the New Testament that these, and let me say this, these Levitical laws were never intended to be permanent.
That's a good point.
Never intended to be permanent. The book of Deuteronomy says, and even alludes to, that God was going to one day circumcise the hearts of his people.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, the circumcision was not always going to be identified in the body, but in the heart. Jeremiah 31 talks about a covenant, a new covenant that was going to come. So it was never intended to be permanent. Okay?
That's good.
So we can't look back and say, well, you don't live the Old Testament laws today, so you're not a Christian. Well, that's a misunderstanding of the law. Law was never intended to be permanent like that. Now, the moral law was.
Mm-hmm.
The moral law was always intended to be it, like the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
The moral law in the Ten Commandments is permanent. But these other laws, beginning after Exodus chapter 20, after the Ten Commandments, they begin immediately in Exodus chapter 20 with laws. Laws about slavery. That's actually the first law that's mentioned in the book of Exodus after the Ten Commandments, is a law about slavery. He says, you have slaves. When you have slaves, or if you have slaves, is what he says. When you do that, here's how you treat your slaves.
Yeah.
You treat your slaves with grace and mercy, and you actually need to redeem those slaves in the seventh year, you need to let them go free. And if they have a wife and kids, let them go too.
Mm-hmm.
And so he begins with that law of slavery, and then he goes into all these other laws. The moral law was going to stay the same, but all these other laws were not intended to be permanent, and not intended to be universal either. They weren't intended for nations outside of national Israel.
Right.
They're not. In other words, these laws were not intended for the United States of America.
Mm-hmm.
They were intended for national
Israel.
For a period of time,
yeah.
we know that that was the case, until we find in the New Testament where Jesus says these animals are
clean
now.
Now, I think it's interesting, too. Okay, so Peter has that vision in Acts chapter 10, okay? And then by the time you get to Acts chapter 15, okay, salvation has really come among the Gentiles in a profound way. They're embracing Jesus and Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
They're being saved, and they come to this council in Acts chapter 15, and I find it interesting that James and John and Peter and the apostles and the elders send this instruction to the Gentiles. And from the law in Leviticus, they only mention two things. Don't eat blood,
mm-hmm.
which is Leviticus 17.
That's right.
And don't eat an animal that's been strangled. I think that's very interesting. You know, they weren't saying clean, unclean distinctions. They weren't worried about all that stuff. They weren't saying obey the law, but they did include those two factors from the law of Moses. And I just find that interesting. I find that, you know, that keep yourself from sexual immorality and don't eat blood.
Yep.
You know, I think that's just a really, there's got to be more there, you know, I think a Gentile would have to step back and say, well, what, you know, okay, but help me understand why I can't eat an animal that's been strangled.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So it's going to take a little bit more. And why did James and John and Peter identify that particular thing among
that's
so many
right.
other things?
Interesting. It is very interesting. And I think there are some answers to that. But you mentioned not eating the blood.
Mm-hmm.
Don't eat the blood. You know, the way that Israelites got the blood out of an animal was by koshering it. Mm. Okay, we like today, you go to the grocery store, you find kosher salt, right? Mm-hmm. It's bigger crystals,
yep.
big hunks of salt, all right? Somebody said it would actually be best to be called koshering salt rather than kosher salt. There's nothing about the salt that is kosher, and meaning there's nothing about the salt that is necessarily correct other than the fact that it has not been. Again, here's the mixing issue again.
Mm-hmm.
It's not been mixed with extra iodine. Mm. So the salt that we use on table salt has extra iodine in it.
Okay.
But kosher salt does not. It is pure salt, okay? And it's in big hunks or big crystals. Mm. What they did back then is they would rub koshering salt all over a piece of meat. And what that would do is draw out the fluid or the bodily fluid and the blood that was still left in that meat.
Mm-hmm.
So when they say don't eat meat with blood in it, that's how they took the blood out.
Mm-hmm.
After you drained the body of blood, you rubbed that salt on the meat, and that's what drew out the fluids and the blood from the rest of the meat.
Yeah.
And that's how they ate it. So that's called
okay.
koshering it.
And I want to make a very important distinction here on eating a medium rare steak. Because here's the thing. That's not blood. I'm serious, man. It's connective tissues mm-hmm. being broken down. The juice is red, but that's
right.
not blood.
That's right. That's
and
right.
So, you know, because I've had this conversation.
We ain't eating the blood.
I'm not eating a bloody steak. It's the tissues breaking down that way. So, anyways, but
thanks
know,
for clarifying that.
That you
for
know,
all
a good
of us
point.
Who eat the, right. the little bit. I don't eat medium rare. I can't eat
yeah.
it. I eat,
yeah.
I eat medium. But
well,
you still get the red.
And, you know, I've got a good friend. He's well known in evangelical life that he will only eat a hamburger, for example, well done, completely fully cooked. He's not going to eat anything. And a steak the same way. He's going to, you know, and he's reading this in terms of the blood. He's not going to eat blood in any kind of meat. So, you know, okay, go for it. You know, but.
Now, I eat my burgers well done.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I
eat my burgers.
I'm there well. Now. I didn't used to be, but now.
I can't eat my burger less than well done. Now, my steak now, I eat about medium. I like some red juice coming out of it, but not my burger.
But, you know, I mean, how would we know that, you know, how would we know that an animal had been choked out? You know, I don't know.
I don't I mean, know either.
You
I don't
know.
And that's how, but that goes back to how very careful the people of God were expected to be when it came to eating their food. Now, that says exactly what God was trying to communicate to them, is that their lives should be lived the same way. Very careful in the way that they live, that they don't cross boundaries into the sinful world, into the sinful activity. Now, that they're to remain pure and clean and watch themselves and take very good care not to jump off into sin. So the caution with which they're to live with their foods and everything. As a matter of fact, one of the laws said they're not supposed to wear clothes made out of materials of two different kinds of
That's
material.
That's right.
Polyester.
Crossing over.
You know, wearing polyester. You couldn't put two different fabrics together. Same reason. He used their clothing as a simple way to say, just like I want you to wear clothing that is pure, one material only, I want you to your life to be lived that way, not to be
Man,
mixed.
That is such a great insight, Matt. I don't think that's ever been really articulated clearly from preaching I've heard or even study that I've heard, that it's not arbitrary that God's not saying you can't have cotton and polyester together.
Right.
But it's an intentional reflection of the purity and holiness of being consecrated to God
That's
as
right.
his people. In some very visible, tangible ways.
It is. And
I mean, that's a huge thing.
That's what God was doing, was making it making holiness tangible, making it so that they could see with their own eyes when they sat down to eat a meal,
right.
The reason why we eat this and we don't eat that is because God is reminding us that we're to remain holy. We're to remain pure. So you have all the, now, there are some people who will argue that clean and unclean foods are clean or unclean because of their hygiene. You know, like people will say, well, vultures were unclean in the Old Testament because they ate their scavengers, they ate roadkill, they eat all this kind of stuff, so you don't eat that. Or pigs. Pigs are known to transmit diseases, and so we don't want to eat that because it's unhealthy. But again, some people would argue that. I just don't think that's that is necessarily the argument of the Old and New Testament. And some people will say, too, that they're not supposed to, that what made things unclean is that they were associated with other religions. Well, that's not the case either, because you had something like the bull.
Yeah.
The bull in certain other pagan religions is very valued.
Yeah, right.
And so that doesn't really make a lot of sense either. And so anyway, as I was reading, I'll sort of end the discussion maybe with this. And I know there's a lot more to be said, and there's a lot more to understand about all this. And we'll get into some of these other laws maybe in later. Because I preached on some of this stuff with my folks on Wednesday night about tattoos and all that kind of stuff, and we went into that and slavery and that kind of stuff. But one of the things that this book that I've read on this, Dr. Copan, really, really helped me with, is to say that clean and unclean may best be answered by looking at Genesis 1 and Genesis 3.
Okay.
All right. Genesis 1, there are three spheres of the animal kingdom in creation. Okay. There's water, air, and land, and those three in that order. So in Genesis chapter 1, we have God creating the water animals, the air animals, the land animals. All right,
okay.
Leviticus 11 deals with all three categories, the same categories, just in a different order. So each animal is distinguished as clean and unclean according to categories: the hooves and chewing the cud, the fins and the scales, all that kind of stuff. Unclean animals are used as symbols, again, or pictures of mixing and blurring of these different categories, an overlapping of boundaries. Now, that's not because the animal that God created was flawed. Now, Genesis 1:31 says that God looked over everything that he had created and said that everything was very good.
Right.
So it's not that any of the animals were flawed. So again, we don't call an animal unclean because it's a bad, or God messed up on that one.
Yep, good point.
God, I should have put hooves on that one. Sorry, that
Second
one's unclean.
Guess.
Let's don't do that one, all right? So it's not because it was anything flawed. God looked at his creation and says, very good. He was very pleased with everything that he made. So the issue is not in unclean and clean, the health of the animal or whatever, that kind of thing is necessarily. It's not because the animal was inferior, but because God chose to use that animal as a symbol of his spiritual expectations for his people. Mm-hmm. Holiness is expressed in purity, being unmixed mm-hmm. with the world, and that's what he's doing in these categories that he's created in the book of Genesis, mm-hmm. all right? And then finally, Genesis chapter 3 with the fall.
Right.
We find out God created everything, and then in Genesis chapter 3, this is where Adam and Eve fell. By the way, we find food prohibitions in the law where God said, don't eat this, don't eat this, don't eat this. Well, a lot of people forget is there were food prohibitions in the garden.
Mm, right.
God already said, I've given you everything to eat, but don't eat that. Mm-hmm. The food prohibitions, not just food, but everything else, God was always going to use prohibition of some sort to test their holiness, mm. to test their faithfulness, to live for him, mm-hmm. and to live in a way that was obedient. Mm. So God is always using that, even in the Garden of Eden, in a pure, perfect world where God says, I've given you everything to eat. Don't eat that. Mm. Don't eat that tree. Don't eat the fruit from that tree. So God, even in the garden, God was had already given a prohibition of food. So
that's good.
In the fall, a curse and death are connected to that prohibition of don't eat this. You ate that food you weren't supposed to eat. Therefore, now you're going to have there's this curse, and now you'll experience death. Mm. Animals, and maybe most people understand this, but animals were created to begin with to eat plants, to be herbivores, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That's what he says. He says, I'm going to give all these animals that I've created, I've given every herb for them to eat. Mm-hmm. We don't get any kind of words in that creation account where God says these animals can eat each other. Now, could be the case. It could be the case that animals were carnivorous to begin with. But we don't get that. We don't get that in the Old Testament where animals ate other animals. We get the idea where God created these animals and told them they're to eat herbs. I've given every herb of the field for them to eat. So from what we understand, and some would disagree, what I understand is that animals to begin with were created to be plant eaters. Hmm. God gave every plant for them to eat. The fall is what brought the curse of death and destruction and decay, and it turned people and animals against each other for food and for violence and those kind of things. In other words, in the Levitical law, in Leviticus chapter 11, the predatory birds, God says you can't eat those. Predators were prohibited in their diet as an illustration that God's people were not to be predators. They were not to prey on other people. Unclean animals were also those that had blemishes, those that were odd-looking animals, those that are odd-looking in appearance or had a blemish. That's an illustration of what was expected of people to avoid. Mm-hmm. They were not to be predators. At the same time, animals that were vulnerable and shouldn't be eaten were illustrations of those who were vulnerable and shouldn't be preyed upon. Mm-hmm. So God was using the food to help them understand how they were supposed to live in holiness. So it's interesting that there's a lot more to be said about all that, but God is simply using food to show them how to be holy.
Man, that's interesting. As you were talking about that, I was thinking about, you know, animals eating other animals would be eating the blood of those animals too,
yeah,
which was also prohibited.
That's right.
So maybe that is a factor as well. Is there, in your opinion, is there a contemporary significance to this for, you know, when Paul says to the church at Corinth, come out from among the world and be separate, mm-hmm. that consecration language, you know, I mean, obviously, we follow the law of Christ and this, but how do we mark ourselves out distinct from the world?
Yeah,
you know, without the minutia of some of these things.
It's a good question. Ephesians chapter 4 says, "Put off the old man and his old ways, and put on the new man according to which he has given you according to God's likeness." Mm-hmm. And so he reminds us in Ephesians chapter 4 that we're to walk that way. We're to walk in holiness and impurity. Don't walk the way that the unsaved you used to walk. Don't be that way anymore. Put off those old behaviors, those old actions, the old way you used to talk, all those. Put off those things and put on the new. Don't mix yourself with the world. You're identified differently now. And according to Ephesians chapter 1, you're identified as a son adopted into the family of God. Live that way. I think that's what his argument is live the way that you've been marked out to live. Mm-hmm. And that means very practically avoiding the behaviors of the world and living a pure and unholy and righteous life, making good choices with what you do and what you say. And that marks us out in this world as people who are holy. It marks us out as people who belong to him. So just like we go back and we look at these Old Testament laws and say, well, we don't do that anymore. What does that mean for us now in the New Testament times? It means the same thing for us. No, we don't necessarily follow those laws, but I think it can mean the same that everything in our life that is just common, God can use to show us what a holy life is, how a holy life is to be expected of us. We're to live the right way. We're to live unmixed from the world.
Right.
And so, no, I mean, I eat bacon.
Yeah, amen.
And I love bacon wrapped in bacon, and you know, wrap it another time with bacon. I love me some bacon. All right, so I don't follow the Old Testament law, but I can be reminded in the fact that God has spoken in his word, these things are still applicable to us. We're to live a holy life that way.
Yeah, you know, 1 John chapter 2, 15 through 17, you know, he says, don't love the world or the things of the world.
Yeah.
Lust of the eyes, lust of flesh, pride of possessions and stuff like that. That there is a way we are definitely living differently, counterculturally.
That's exactly right.
And, you know, some of the touchstone issues in our culture, I think Christians would be should keep attention, pay attention to what's going on in the culture, and not follow those things.
That's
not follow the priorities of the flesh and those kind of things. Man, you said it really well.
Well,
I think that's it.
Hopefully that gives some understanding to some Old Testament stuff that a lot of times we don't understand.
I think so.
Let me close the podcast. Get closer to it anyway.
Okay.
Let's end with a segment today that we sometimes end with called headlines.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a headline that is real big right now in our culture just over the last few days, and I'm interested in to see what you think about this and how you might process this. There's a headline lately and you may have a headline, you may have an exact headline on this, about a large caravan of people from South America that are approaching the American border. Give us a headline. I think you've got one right there. Let's process that for a second.
Well, USA Today's running a headline. Basically what you say, caravan of migrants bound for U.S. swells to 5,000. That's in USA Today. And then I see something here on the Daily Wire that it could be as many as 10,000 people.
Oh, my goodness.
Currently, it looks like they're about 1,800 miles from El Paso, Texas.
Okay.
So on
and they're
foot,
walking.
Yeah, they're on foot, and this article is interesting. It says Google Maps said it would take 573 hours for them to reach El Paso.
Wow.
So, yeah, from what I've read, you pointed out to me that I guess it started in Honduras, and they're collecting people along the way. They broke down a border in Guatemala into Mexico, and so now they're making their way to U.S. I'm not really sure what's going on, man. I don't know. Are they intending to come and make their home in the U.S.? Mm-hmm. Is this a political statement? I mean, what? I'm not really sure. You brought it to my attention, and I've kind of done just a real quick research on it. And it's like it's a frustrated mob of migrants coming into, you know, waving their country's flags, trying to get in. Apparently, the end game is to the U.S. I don't imagine they're going to Canada.
No, I don't think they're passing through.
Yeah, so I'm not really sure.
It's a good question. I don't know exactly. You know, we talk about how to respond to these things in a Christian manner.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been a lot of our talk lately, politically, it has been for a long time, about border stuff and security. No, and I don't get into all that, but Christians have to start dealing with some of this stuff from a Christian worldview to say, how do we approach this? How do we treat people like that? There's some real issues there. There's some real security issues that are important for us to understand, because we're at a point now where if you're going to have 10,000 potentially 10,000 people trying to cross a border, That's a major security issue
for
the people of El Paso, Texas,
no doubt.
If that's where we're going to cross over.
And then once they're in the country, they're here.
Yeah, and
there's no way to know who they are.
Yeah, it becomes a real and the question then has to become, you know, because I think one of the headlines said something about desperate refugees
that
are coming for, maybe they're coming for asylum, they're coming for safety. That may be the truth, and there may be ways that we as Christians need to respond responsibly to them, to give them a place of asylum, a place of security. But at the same time, you don't know the group that large, and all these people that they've picked up along the way, too.
Exactly.
How many of these people are legit?
Oh, yeah.
How many of these people are not violent drug dealers waiting to get into the country?
That's right. Cartel members.
With a caravan.
Yeah. We don't know, and I think it's irresponsible for anyone, Christian included, just to assume that we're going to, arms wide open, you know, suck up 10,000 people with no process of identification, I think that's irresponsible.
I agree with you.
Now,
especially for the cities they're going to cross into immediately.
Yeah, and there's no doubt, you know, that we convictionally believe every single man and woman is created in the image of God. They have value and dignity. No doubt there's some in this crowd that are hopeless and frustrated and needing help and stuff. But how do you find the middle ground of thinking, do we have a process of truly helping, identifying and helping people that really need without, you know, just laying down and, you know, because what country would?
Right.
I mean, why is it assumed that the U.S. is just going to accept this kind of what looks like to be an invasion or assault? That kind of language may be a little strong, but I think, you know, when if this was England, for example, and boats were coming over from other countries waving their flags, I'm talking about 10,000 strong, how would England respond to this?
Right.
Would they say, hey, come on in? Or would they say, you know, we need a process of identifying who you are?
Right.
What are your intentions for our country? You're waving flags and stuff, which seems strange.
That would be the responsible thing, is to say, we want you here.
Yeah.
We want to accept, but there got to be a way to do this.
Well, you know? I think if we're being honest, there's a lot of Americans that would say, we don't want you here.
Yeah.
I think, and that's part of the... That's part of the narrative.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's
of
true.
And I'm not throwing elbows at, you know, Trump or whatever, but I think there's a fervor in our culture automatically against any immigrants whatsoever, documented or undocumented. We don't want you here. We're Americans, and I think that's wrong, man. I think we've been a country built upon, you know, immigrants,
right?
For a long, long, long time. But where we've lost our way, I think, is how do we process and inculcate people that want to come and make a life for themselves here as Americans, rather than coming in to this country and retaining their identity of whatever they are, not even in a hyphenated sense that I'm a Mexican American, but just a full on Mexican family or Honduran family living in the United States with no concern whatsoever to become an American, to live according to, you know, the way every other American lives in this country. I think there's room to really think through that and talk about, well, what does that look like?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't have anything to do with the dignity of the person.
Right.
I don't care what country you're from.
Right.
But I'm talking about the identity of this nation as a sovereign nation state for itself. Mm. I don't know, man. I mean, I don't typically dance in political circles and stuff like this. But it is interesting because you got this massive throng of people coming.
Yeah, and you can't deny that.
You can't deny it.
I mean, you're not talking about 100 people trying to cross the border. I mean, you're talking thousands of people.
5,000, 10,000.
And men, women, children, all this are trying. So I don't know. It's a big deal, and I'm curious to see how we're going to respond to this, or how our leadership is going to respond. I mean, you got to think this is going to be some like military involved, some kind of way of saying.
I wonder.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I wish I had the answers, but
no doubt, media is going to make it a circus.
Yeah,
and Trump's going to be evil.
Yeah,
and You know, so I think we need to be discerning on that kind of stuff. But, you know, it seems to me like from the things I read that the crowd is chanting stuff like, yes, we can, and, you know, we can do this. And I'm just uncertain of what's going on here.
Yeah.
Are you just going to make a point that you can bust up in the U.S. come hell or high water?
Right.
I don't know what, you know, because people are saying, no one will stop us, only God.
Hmm.
We will knock down the door and keep walking.
Wow.
So, I don't know, man. That's going to be met with some pretty significant resistance, I think.
I would think so. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But
Pray for wisdom for our leaders.
We do need to pray for wisdom. Yeah. We do need to pray that and that we as Christians, too, respond in the right way.
That's right.
That we have the right.
That's right.
That we have a godly attitude, and we approach things like this the right way. We want to be responsible biblically to do that. So,
yeah.
Well, let me close the podcast, man. There's a lot more to talk about, and we'll do some more on the next Gospel Rain podcast. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and all that other kind of stuff. You can share us out there. But if you've got questions, things that you want us to tackle theologically, biblically, we'd love to do that. So just share those questions with us on Facebook and Twitter. Go to the website, gospelrain.com. You can find us there, and you can share us with your friends, and we will see you again next time on the Gospel Rain podcast.
Thank you for joining us for the Gospel Rain podcast. We hope you've been encouraged today, and we pray the gospel will reign in your life this week. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or check out our website at gospelrain.com.